You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 24th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Do you guys hear about this guy in New Zealand, Dr. Lance O'Sullivan? Almost sounds like
Oh, yeah, made up name. It did.
Apparently, he was the New Zealander of the Year in 2014. So he was at a screening of the movie Vaxxed, which is that horrible anti-vaccine propaganda piece of crap film.
Was that from last year?
By
Steve?
Andrew Wakefield. At the end of the movie, he jumps up on stage and starts berating the audience.
I suppose because the audience like gave it a standing
ovation. Yeah, he starts trashing the film. Like he says, I come here with a lot of anger, and that's because I am adamantly opposed to this, because this position, this idea of anti-immunization has killed children around the world and actually will continue to kill children whose parents are put off immunization because of misinformation. Misinformation based on lies, quite frankly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did he actually sit through the whole movie?
I guess.
Apparently.
I wonder how big the audience was and what their reaction to what he said was.
Yeah, both of those guys were very upset.
Well, good for him. I mean, you know what? That's
right. Stand up and...
No, but think about it. I mean, there are times in the life of an activist where you just got to leave your comfort zone and do something, you know, and this was a great example of someone just saying, what the hell? No, I'm not going to let people walk out of this theater or wherever they played it with this ridiculous information in their head without me being able to say something on top of that. And I completely applaud him for having a nerve to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
But he's very articulate. You know what I mean? He's not like some crazy guy. You know, he knows
he's their person
about.
Of the year.
Well,
yeah. Well, for 2014, I don't know what that was for. Lance O'Sullivan. Lance is one of those, that's like a TV name, Lance.
Yeah. That's like the hot guy in the high school class.
Yeah.
Lance Donovan.
All right, Bob, get us started with a forgotten superhero of science.
Yes, for this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science, I'm going to talk about Julius Jungner, 1920 to April 2017, just last month. So microbiologist, geneticist, virologist, and was on the original three-person team that rid the world of polio. I had never heard of this guy, but Jungner probably developed an interest in infectious diseases after having a bout of some nasty infections as he was growing up. I'm sure that it left a mark on him. Literally and figuratively. And we all know Jonas Salk, but what about the others on his team that jointly developed the first polio vaccine? That's exactly who Jungner was. Jungner was the last surviving member of that original three-man research team that Dr. Jonas Salk put together at the University of Pittsburgh. Apparently, Salk eventually credited all of his team members with major roles in the vaccine. So let me just talk about polio in the context of that time. I mean, the early 50s, at its peak, 50,000 kids got polio in that year, in the early 50s. Crazy. At 50,000, when they finally did announce a 90% effective cure, church bells were literally being run across the country in celebration. You know, they were actually filling up pools again, community pools, because they thought it was just too risky to have all these kids swimming in the same water. Around 6 years later, fewer than 1,000 people got polio, and by 1979, it was effectively gone from developed nations. Just an amazing success story. Dr. Salk's son, Peter L. Salk, was even bold enough to say about Jungner that, I think it's absolutely fair to say that had it not been for Dr. Jungner, the polio vaccine would not have come into existence. Now, I think he said that on the occasion of Jungner's death last month or so. So I was like, well, okay, a little, you know, funeral hyperbole perhaps. But consider this. Jungner created the process to produce enough of the virus for experimentation and then production. He also figured out how to cripple the virus, yet still have it produce antibodies, right? That's kind of key. You know, when you inject, you know, you want to inject deactivated viruses. So yeah, kind of important. And if that's not enough, he came up with a test to measure the amount of antibodies to see if it was working. So three, talk about a huge contribution that really puts Salk's son's comment into perspective. That's not hyperbole. If that's true, damn. So then this kind of leads to the one big bummer about this whole thing that I came across. And as we often see with women scientists that I mention all the time, Jonas Salk just did not give his team credit for a vaccine for a while, apparently. So Jungner is reported to have said to Salk himself, after not seeing him for 27 years, from like 61 to 93 or something around there, Jungner said, apparently, "Do you remember whom you mentioned and whom you left out? Do you realize how devastated we were at that moment and ever afterward when you persisted in making your coworkers invisible?"
Ooh, burn.
So that's a big, big damn burn and pisses me off. Especially, I mean, these guys weren't, you know, research assistants. These were full-fledged partners. And I mean, just remember what I said about what Jungner actually accomplished. Like, it makes me think to a certain extent, well, what were the other guys doing? You know, like, damn, those are the three big three that he did. I'm sure there's many, many steps and they all contributed very, very much, but that's no small accomplishment what he did. So remember Julius Jungner. Maybe even overwrite some of your Jonas Salk memories if you can. mention him to your friends, perhaps when talking about trypsinization or perhaps vesicular stomatitis.
Whoa, Bob.
Oh, yeah, baby.
That sounds bad.
Yeah.
I don't want that.
Trip to what now?
Trypsinization.
Oh, thank you.
I'm more worried about the stomatitis.
Yeah, that one sounds nastier, but trypsinization is actually the nicer word. That's actually the process I mentioned. That he created to produce enough of the virus for experimentation and production. So that's what that is. So yeah, cool, great to know. It's just so funny how you focus on one person for a major scientific discovery like that, and often don't even know about the people that were absolutely critical. And apparently we never heard these guys' names because partly at least because of Salk himself.
Yeah, it's part of, I think, the culture that we tend to like really oversimplify scientific discovery and assign it to very few rock stars when in fact it is so much of a team effort, but it's just hard, you know, to track like all of the contributions that multiple teams of different people contribute to any real significant progress. You know, and this is getting more and more true as science progresses, but we're kind of stuck.
Sure.
Yeah, with this concept of the lone superstar, like making these discoveries by their own genius.
That's fine. That's fine. And let that, you know, kind of happen organically. But, you know, even if you're leading a team that makes a huge discovery, you know, acknowledge your colleagues. I mean, that's the least you can do.
And let
history decide who to accentuate, but at least don't give history, a head start.
Yeah. The technical term for that within the world of science is a dick move.
Yeah. Right. And unfortunately, history is full of dick moves, especially against women.
Oh, my God.
I know you guys haven't seen it yet. I've been pushing you to watch Genius on Nat Geo, which is a bio show about Einstein. But in the last episode, or maybe two episodes ago, they parallel his relationship with his first wife, Mileva, who helped him with a lot of his early physics.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they paralleled that story with the story of the Curies. And I don't know how much of this is embellished or not, but they show the representative from the Nobel Committee coming in to Mr. Curie or Dr. Curie and saying, like, you've been nominated, like, you're going to win the Nobel Prize. And he's like, my wife too? And they were like, well, obviously, no. You did all the work. And he rejected it. He said, I won't take it unless they give it to both of us.
Whoa.
Because.
Awesome.
Yeah, because it's like she wasn't his assistant, but everybody viewed Marie as his lab assistant.
Sure, because that was the culture at the time.
Yep.
And speaking of anti-vaxxers, I have to remind our listeners that we came extremely close to eradicating polio. It was down to Nigeria.
Wow.
An anti-vaccine fear campaign. Basically, the rumor got out that the evil West was trying to spread AIDS through the vaccine, and that sort of scuttled the vaccine program there, and that allowed polio to rebound and spread to other countries, and now it's in India and related countries who were trying to do it again. You know, but we
could have eradicated it. Is it in India or is it just in Pakistan?
Yeah, you might be right. It might be Pakistan.
Yeah, I think it's Pakistan and maybe three different African countries at this point.
Yeah.
So, Steve, what are you saying?
We're close.
We should Are you saying that we should just kill people that have polio?
No.
Yeah.
Polio, but we have polio down. I actually had I actually had Jay Wagner on my other podcast that that I do. And Jay Wagner is the lead polio scientist for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And we talked about eradication efforts, and it was fascinating because he was saying there are so few people left with polio that, or at least that we know of, that they know all the genetic markers within their polio because these people have been screened left, right, and center. They're getting the best medical attention in the world because we don't want it to spread. So, no, we don't kill them. We give them the best treatment possible.
Oh, man, you just think if it's that low, how much effort could it possibly take?
Well, it's because these people are living in places where they don't have access to clean water. They don't have access to good medical attention. You know, obviously, it takes these people going out and finding them, like these epidemiologists going into these small remote villages and testing everybody anytime that they hear a case of the symptoms of polio, going out and testing people and trying to figure out if they have it. And also, remember, too, people can carry polio without ever having the symptoms. And so they have to really be careful that they're like, that nobody is showing any symptoms anymore. So I don't think you can really say something's fully eradicated until it's...
What do? You call it contained? Is that the...
It's definitely contained right now. Let's see. Yeah, one in 200 infections lead to paralysis. Only one in 200. So plenty of people like don't, you know, they might have some symptoms, but it's hard for them to know if it's polio or if something else is causing it. And we've decreased it 99% since 88. So there used to be 350,000 cases, I think, per year or overall. And in 2016, there were only 37 reported cases.
Wow. Science, come on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And this is by the World Health Organization is where I'm reading this.
So it's accurate.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if we didn't do what we're doing now, there would probably be 200,000 new cases a year. And within 10 years, polio would be respread all over the world.
Yeah.
It's because of this very concerted effort by the World Health Organization, the CDC, and Polio Now, Rotary International is one of their biggest groups, and now Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and, you know, other people, I'm leaving people out. But because of that End Polio Now campaign, we're down to, you know, double digits. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Almost there. And once it's gone, it's gone. You know,
it's gone forever.
Yeah.
There's no reservoir other than humans.
That's right.
They don't have they don't keep it in a lab in a jar or something.
Oh, maybe.
Of course. Come on.
Yeah, but it's gone. It's you're right. Okay, but people
gone from the wild.
It's gone.
It's gone from from
wild type poliovirus.
Wild exposure, right.
All right. So Kara, do human beings have an innate understanding of numbers, or is that something cultural that we have to learn?
Good question, Steve.
Just a random thought.
Yeah. Much more complicated than we think. So I love this story because I've actually often thought about that question. I don't know if you guys have. And I'm wondering kind of what is your take on it? Do you think that we are just biologically predisposed, that this is a function of natural selection, that we can use numbers? Or do you think that a lot of that is culturally bound?
I think it's both.
Well, how about it starts
as
being inherent and then our culture helps refine it and bring it along.
Yeah, I think that our ability for abstract mathematical reasoning is like language in that
exactly.
We have more of it than any other species. The fact that there are some people who are just mathematical geniuses, I think indicates that there's got to be some kind of genetic hardwiring component to it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But clearly also there has to be a huge cultural component as well. You have to learn it. You have to learn math, you know. I don't think people are born knowing math, but the potential, the talent for math varies so much. It's like music or language or, you know, it's one of those just things. You have a certain combination of genes, you have a certain, you know, pattern of networks in your brain, and that's an ability that you have. It's what interests me most is how much is it an epiphenomenon versus at one point were there any actual selective pressures specifically for mathematical ability, and why would that have been? That's interesting.
That is a really interesting question. Yeah. So basically the news peg here is that there was a short write around in Cosmos Magazine, which is an Australian publication. I love it. If you guys don't follow it, you might want to add it to your lists. It was written by Stephen Fleischfresser. What a name. And he noticed that in Trends in Cognitive Sciences, there are two letters that were written by different researchers. The first by Rafael Nunez, who is at the University of California, San Diego. And the second is by Andreas Nieder, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who is at a university in Germany, which I cannot pronounce. It's something like Tübingen. You like that? Tübingen. And they basically are at each other's throats in these letters, which is so fun to read.
Awesome.
They show up. Yeah, they show up back to back in Trends in Cognitive Sciences. Nunez and Nieder are writing about this kind of evolved capacity, but they really specifically focus on the word number. And I think that is the semantic argument that their conversation comes down to. Does number arise from a biological capacity or a cultural capacity, or is it some combination? Now, Nieder, the German researcher, is pretty firm in his stance that there is biological capacity for such things. In some places, I think he might be oversimplifying Nunez's argument, kind of trying to make it dichotomous and saying Nunez is saying, no, it's cultural only. But even Nunez within his piece is like, he's going to say, I'm saying it's just culture, and it's not just culture. There's, you know, a lot of interplay between culture and biology. But he talks about the fact that if you're looking purely at natural selection, you can only look at genetic passing on of traits. But if you're looking at culture and natural selection, you're looking at genes being passed on to progeny, but you can also see cultural changes that happen horizontally. They can happen downwards to progeny, but they can even happen backwards to the older generations. So he makes that distinction. But also, I think the most important distinction here is between the idea of number and the idea of quantity, like a vague idea of quantity. And I think both researchers agree that loose quantification, not actually putting numbers on things, but thinking in terms of kind of a non-symbolic quantification, that is probably biologically predisposed. And the reason that they think that is because we see it in non-human primates. Mm-hmm. We can even see it in some actually non-primate mammals as well. But Nieder argues that the biological capacity is there even for numeracy, in that we can kind of train it in to non-human primates and even some other. He doesn't specifically talk about elephants, but I'm going back to the elephant example because I've seen studies using elephants for kind of counting mechanisms, and birds as well. Whereas Nunez argues that that's purely a byproduct of training, and that's purely cultural, that there's nothing inherent in a bird that means that they could count. They didn't evolve an ability to count, although they might have an evolved ability to know the difference between less than or more than, for example. The interesting thing that they both point out is that 85% of nearly 200 languages from Aboriginal Australia that were surveyed don't have numerals beyond 5. So even though numerals are present in every known human culture, some of these earlier cultures are known to not have either necessitated a number beyond 5 or just never developed a number beyond 5. And so I think these two researchers look at that differently. I think that Nieder sees that as, well, that's just further proof that just because they didn't go beyond 5, they still have numeracy. And I think that Nunez sees this as basically like a basic ability for thinking in vague quantities, but a lack of capacity to move beyond that without sufficient culture, that it must be passed down culturally, because without the cultural kind of seeds there, the individuals obviously didn't develop it. He uses a snowboarding metaphor throughout his piece. He says that basically snowboarding has certain things within it that are, quote, rooted in our biological heritage. That's the phrase that Nieder uses a lot. Nunez doesn't really love it. But he's saying, you know, in snowboarding, you've got things like bipedal action, balancing, optic flow navigation, all these different things that like we are biologically predisposed to have. But nobody would say that snowboarding was a trait that was passed down via natural selection, right? There's no selection pressure to be good at snowboarding, and then humans develop this ability to be good at snowboarding.
I don't think that's a great analogy. Well,
yeah, Nader doesn't like that analogy. Nader is like, okay, math is so much more complicated than snowboarding. And I think that there, and I mean, he doesn't really say it in these terms, but it seems like he's hinting at the fact that there is a specific numerical ability that exists that's not just a piecemeal of all these other little things that allow us to use numbers. And he makes the comparison to language quite often.
Mm-hmm.
They both, Steve, based on what you were saying about, like, is this something that was developed specifically for the capability of counting? Were there pressures that necessitated counting? They both use the term exaptation when talking about this, which is a word we covered on the show, that this was likely a skill that was developed or a capability that was developed for some other purpose that then we utilize once counting became necessary for survival. So, and I mean, who knows? There's no way to actually know if that's true, but seems like an interesting argument.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I do think it's the fact that these two guys have different opinions tells you how complicated it is to think about this sort of thing. It is true that we have a part of our brain that where the ability to do calculations localizes to, and if that part of your brain is damaged, it's the dominant parietal lobe, then you lose the ability. You could have what's called acalculia. You don't have the ability to do even simple calculations. It's a focal finding, a focal brain lesion will do that. So it's clearly there. You know, it's and that part of your brain doesn't arise because of culture. It's there already. But I think the culture determines how it manifests, which is true of so many things, you know.
And the question is it just happenstance that we utilize it for numeracy now, which has been passed on in Nunez's view, at least culturally, yet it has functional capacity for other things. So yeah, damaging that part of the brain may knock out our numeracy, but that doesn't mean that that part of the brain was developed for numeracy or was passed down for numeracy.
Well, I think that's kind of like asking, did we develop language so that we could do poetry? Well, no, it's that the poetry is a specific cultural manifestation of our very highly developed linguistic ability. Music is fascinating. Why the hell, you know, does music have the cultural, you know, impact and emotional impact that it has? I think that's largely an epiphenomenon. But then once it takes on a life of its own, does it then become under selective pressure? I mean, there's so many ways that you could imagine that the ability to count would be useful, even in a very primitive culture. You know, if you're going up against another tribe, well, who has more people? You know, you're coming back from a hunt. Is everybody here? Let's do a head count, you know? Let's see.
And you're splitting up the spoils. Like, how come he has more than I do?
Yeah.
I should get the same number as him.
How about the idea of exaptation? How does that fit into this?
So basically what I think both researchers are saying, because both agree that there's a fundamental capacity that's inherent biologically that happened through natural selection. The difference between their arguments is that one is specifically for numeracy and the other is for more abstract thought of quantity, and that numeracy is a cultural product that was then superimposed upon that or utilized by that. The exaptation is really just, you know, perhaps we developed these capabilities for some other use first, and then when being able to think about numbers became necessary. And that goes back to that, you know, that specified brain region, right? Yes, if you knock it out, you lose your capability to calculate, but what other kind of skills might be required? Are you going to have other sort of deficits based on that?
Or a deficit that would not be really noticed now, but maybe would be noticed 50,000 years ago.
Or maybe it's not even localized there anymore, right? Another, you know, part of the brain took up that architecture. I think so. The main difference really between their two arguments is about that idea of numeracy. But one thing that I think I should point out is that Nader, the guy who's arguing that numeracy itself has a biological basis, he represents the more accepted view. So Nunez's claim that numeracy specifically is cultural, is actually kind of the rocking the boat claim here.
Right.
Yep.
Which is interesting. He does make one other, you know, he makes the argument based on the hunter-gatherer societies who only have these counting words up to five. He also makes the argument that English and Chinese speakers use different brain regions when they process Arabic numerals. And so that's another argument that he says based on the language you learn, if it's a pictorial language or representative language with letters, you may actually have different brain regions that are responsible for how you calculate.
But so what? Because that could just be that there's an interaction between the part of your brain that calculates and the part of your brain that processes language, because that's abstraction. And just like with music, you're going to process music probably differently depending on what language you hear, right? You learn to speak.
It's true.
Yeah, all those things interact. And this is what I teach medical students this every day, you know, pretty much when I'm going over with them how to interpret the neurological exam, especially how to interpret the mental status exam, is that you cannot completely disentangle all of these things. We actually try to isolate one network ability in the brain so that we could test it to see if there's any damage to that circuit. But you can't. You can't perfectly isolate any circuit when it comes to the higher cognitive abilities, because they're all interrelated. They're all interacting with each other. The best we could do is really triangulate. You know, you got to test everything and interpret everything in the context of all the other tests to see what's the common thread here. What's giving them the most difficulty, for example. But you can't just, like, there isn't a test that completely isolates one thing, like even calculation, in the absence of attention and language and, you know, memory, and all these things work together for any task that we do. So from that perspective, it's like, yeah, these things are all connected. So it makes sense that Chinese and English speakers are going to process math differently. Sure. I don't think that really makes a big argument on his side, but it's hard. It's complicated.
It is complicated. And I am wondering if it contributes to the argument, which to my naive kind of, you know, perspective of this, I see a lot of analogy between language and the ability to calculate. So, you know, nobody would argue, we might say that we have an innate capacity for language, but nobody would argue that without culture we would have language, because we've seen it in feral children who don't know how to speak. Unless you're taught how to speak, you might babble, you might make vocalizations, but you aren't going to develop language. It requires a cultural component. So to me, the argument that numerical ability has more of that cultural binding and just the capacity for quantification is biological seems quite reasonable, but it would be super interesting if anybody had thought to do number studies with those feral children.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, what a bummer that we don't have that data.
We have to make some more.
It would be, I was going to say, is there an ethics problem with
Oh, yeah, we'll get there when I get to my word this week.
Yeah. We'll put them in a Monroe box.
We isolate them and pour cold water on them for 20 years.
All right, thanks, Kara. So, guys, you guys remember the research by Daryl Bem, right? The 2011 published a series of studies.
I'd love a recap.
Yeah. Which I'm in the process of giving you. In 2011, he published a series of 10 experiments in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, in which he claimed that to have solid, rigorous scientific evidence that people can, quote-unquote, feel the future. That what he did was he reversed the usual direction of standard psychological experiments. For example, the effects of studying on memory, right? So you have people try to remember two batches of words, and then you have them study one batch of words after you test them. And he claimed that later studying one batch of words improved their performance on recalling them, as if that studying reached back in time to influence their testing. So this sparked a bit of a controversy, right, between the usual players, right? The skeptical scientific community was like, no. that's clearly impossible, violates the, you know, causality, physics, a whole bunch of stuff. So, yeah, that evidence is just not convincing enough for us to completely alter our conception of reality. And then the ESP believers are like, hey, he followed all the rules. He did standard, rigorous scientific studies. Yep. He produced
case closed.
Yeah, Psy exists. Statistically significant results, published it in a peer-reviewed journal. It's like, we're right. We did it. We proved ESP is real because we followed all the rules. So, now, of course, you know, the proof of any, you know, new finding like this is always, can it be replicated? So, a bunch of people, Richard Wiseman among them, if you recall, tried to replicate BEM's research and their results were negative. But some ESP proponents tried to replicate his work and claim positive results. So you had these dueling replications. Now, all of this, you know, we've been talking about this, like all of this has the hallmarks of, you know, what I would now call p-hacking, right? Where, yeah, you just, you know, fudge the research a little bit, you know, here and there in order to eke out a statistically significant result. But the effect sizes are razor thin, and they don't universally replicate. Like, if you have to be a believer to see it, that's NRAs, right? You have to have some kind of prior belief and that skeptics are coming up negative. That's all the hallmarks of this phenomenon ain't real. But as long as that was the status, nothing really was accomplished because the skeptics were still skeptical and the believers were still believers. So, but BEM, to his credit, and he doesn't get much credit in this story, we'll give him this credit, did facilitate other people replicating his research. And eventually he and some of his colleagues, Schlitz and Delorme, they developed a protocol. Basically said, all right, we're going to do a rigorous protocol. We're going to make all of the decisions about the endpoints and how much data we're going to collect ahead of time, right? Which is what you need to do to eliminate p-hacking. You need to make those decisions ahead of time. And then we're going to have a bunch of people do it. We'll have believers do it. We'll have skeptics do it. They're going to be following the exact protocol with agreed upon outcomes. And then we'll see what happens.
Excellent. Yeah,
that's the way to do it, right? That's what we call consensus, you know, replication. Now, BEM hypothesized that the skeptics would come up negative and the believers would come up positive because skeptics were using their own anti-ESP ESP in order to suppress the results.
Right. I forgot that we could do that.
What? Yeah. I don't even understand that.
It's a superpower we have, Kara. We can suppress.
Why did you guys tell me about this?
Yeah. it's natural.
We don't acknowledge it.
Right. Yeah, Kara, in about a year, you'll develop this. Don't be scared.
Okay. All right. Help me through it.
You'll notice that psychics can't perform around you.
Wait, that's already happening.
Yeah, and that... Yeah, ESP will look like bullshit to you. Okay, so fine. They did it. They all did this. You know, they replicated this rigorous protocol. They eliminated p-hacking. They presented the results actually in over the summer of 2016. They're about to publish them in a journal, but they presented them at a meeting at a conference. And guess what they found?
Nothing.
Nothing. It was dead negative across the board. Skeptic
including
and believer alike. Yes, because
and believer. Why?
Yeah, because they eliminated p-hacking. Because
they did the right thing.
BEM is a p-hacker, and when you when you eliminate the possibility for p-hacking, spurious results go away. So that's what happened. It was beautiful. It played out exactly like real science is supposed to. That's why I have to give them credit for that.
I'm actually kind of surprised that it did work out that way, only because I think my own sort of unfair bias is that a true believer in ESP is likely not going to be a rigorous scientist in the lab.
No, so
they were sort of forced into it by the other scientists.
You know, some people say, I didn't really connect these dots, but some people say that BEM's research actually did spawn a lot of this the replication crisis that we're having right now, especially in the social sciences. This idea that, if Bem followed all the rules and he showed that the impossible works, that means that our science is broken, that we're doing it wrong. Because his results are impossible. So if our methods yield impossible results, the universe isn't different than we thought. Our methods just suck.
No, his methods just suck.
Yeah, well, but the thing is, he really was following what is pretty standard procedure, and especially in this social psychology. So
has nobody been able to point out what would be responsible for his outcome?
Yes, it's blatant. So because Bem openly advocates for what constitutes p-hacking. If you remember, we had Wagenmachers on the show a couple years, like when this was happening, and he's another researcher, and he's like, if you read like Bem's like textbook chapters, he basically outlines p-hacking. You know, he thinks that that's legitimate research methods. And so when you eliminate, and the problem is that we're finding that this is actually more prevalent than we think, you know, and that until you get to the consensus rigorous replications, you don't really know if an effect is real or not. So this goes beyond ESP. This is like infiltrating a lot of science, and not just this, not just social psychology, but medicine. And a lot. This is why we've been talking about this on science-based medicine for years. Like, yeah, you have to do rigorous replications. This is why. All right. But listen to this. This is amazing.
There's more.
After the negative results, right? They published the negative results, but they also, in their conference abstract, get this. Bem and his co-authors found a way to wring positive droplets of confirmation from the data. After adding in a set of new statistical tests ex post facto, they concluded that the evidence for ESP was indeed highly significant. So,
how?
They just decided.
They went back and p-hacked.
Q-hacking.
Confirmation bias.
They cheated.
They cheated. So they said, so when you don't cheat and you eliminate p-hacking, the results are negative. So they went back and then re-added new statistical tests. That's p-hacking. And said, oh, look at that. We have positive results. So they snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. They did it. They did the rigorous research. They did the replication, the consensus study with the believers and skeptics, and they didn't have the guts to abide by the result. So they went back and cheated so that they could salvage their positive results.
Save face, right?
Can we put them in jail?
No.
Yeah.
Come on.
No, they're just checking. They're just embarrassed. They're just scientifically defunct.
You put them in
defunct.
Academic jail.
Yeah, they're just scientifically defunct. So, all right.
Does Bem acknowledge that p-hacking is a thing and it really exists?
Well, you want to hear what Bem has to say about it?
Sure.
So this is a quote from Bem in an article, a very good article in Slate about the whole affair. And Bem wrote, here we go. He says, I'm all for rigor, but I prefer other people do it. I see it's important. It's fun for some people, but I don't have the patience for it. If you looked at all my past experiments, they were always rhetorical devices. I gathered data to show how my point would be made. I used data as a point of persuasion, and I never really worried about will this replicate or not.
Oh, my God.
So...
did he not take science classes in school?
Yeah,
like, how did he get his PhD?
Well. This is consistent. So, like, again, if you read his chapters, he's like, yeah, so, you know, if you get negative results, look at the data sideways. Look at it this other way. Look at these other variables. Analyze it again. He's basically a manual of p-hacking. That's what he is recommending. What he doesn't realize is that that means your results are meaningless.
Yeah.
Because your statistics are now not valid. Because the statistical significance is only real if you do no p-hacking, which basically means that you're making decisions about how to gather and analyze data as you go along, right? If you reanalyze data, introduce new analyses, new comparisons, new statistical comparisons, every time you do that, it's like throwing the dice again. And then if you get the results you want, you can't say, oh, that was a p-value of 0.05. No, you can't. Right. It's not.
We're done.
You have to adjust it for everything that you did. And when you do that, the statistical significance goes away. Or you just don't do that. You don't do anything that constitutes p-hacking. That's the point of exact replications. And that's why so many things fail to replicate, because what they're doing is they're factoring out the p-hacking. And so that's why, you know, it's science-based medicine, and this is part of like the whole skeptical thing now. It's like, we only know if something is really real when it replicates reliably with rigorous protocols that eliminate the possibility of p-hacking. Only then do we know if it's real. And that takes time to get to that most rigorous research. But of course, most studies aren't at that level, which is why, if you remember, we talked about this too, from Unitas, most published studies are wrong, because most published studies are basically p-hacking. And it's only when you start to replicate them in rigorous ways do you know which ones are real and which ones are not real. ESP, not real.
But so doesn't that bum you out? I have to say, like, you mentioned the Slate article, and the Slate article is really in depth. And I think that Daniel Engber, did a really good job digging into this. I didn't have as much background, but when I came across this article at first, I shared it with like all my friends, and I was like, derp, derp, derp. I'm so annoyed. And they were like, why? It's a really good article. And I was like, because, and we've talked about this so many times on the show, the headline is such a bummer. Yeah. The headline of this article is Daryl Bem proved ESP is real, which means science is broken.
Yeah, that was hyperbole.
Yeah, it was supposed to come off as...
I could see where they're coming from,
not,
but it was...
But that doesn't mean the science is wrong. That means that people are misusing the science.
Yeah. It just means we need to rededicate ourselves to a higher level of rigor. Yeah. That's what that means.
So science isn't broken. There's a crisis in how we use science.
Yeah, in how some people use science. And what this means, the bottom line, if you want me to just one line it for you, it means that the skeptics are right. It's true, because this is what we have been saying for decades. And the literature is catching up to what we've been saying, that they're using too much wiggle room in order to massage these razor thin but statistically significant results. But if it's highly implausible, I'm not going to believe it until I see it rigorously replicated. And now we just know in more quantitative, exacting ways that that's exactly correct. And this story, Bem's story, is a microcosm now for basically all of science. This is
it's a good example.
It's a beautiful story, absolutely beautiful. And the tag at the end that Bem got all the way to the right answer and then flinched and then reintroduced the p-hacking just shows you how vacuous the ESP field of research is.
That it also shows you how strong sacred cows can be.
But that's what you
can't.
But the thing is, this
motivated reasoning.
This is the moment of truth in science, when you have two schools of thought, they agree on a protocol, they do it, and then one side is right. And what does the other side do at that point? That's the moment of truth. At that point, you are either a scientist who accepts the results, or you are a pseudoscientist who puts your head back in the sand and makes up some bullshit special pleading reason why you were still right. And so Bem and Schlitz and the other guys, they just showed that they're pseudoscientists. They proved
it. And it helps with the
– They proved it.
Helps with the demarcation problem too.
That's it. They failed their come to Jesus moment spectacularly. And just proved again what we were saying all the whole time: the whole field of ESP research is bankrupt. And this is not an isolated example. This is what they do. This was just now the most dramatic example. And partly because Bem was held up as, look at this, was rigorous science proving ESP, and that brought the whole debate to a head. And I think the result is unequivocal. Very interesting.
Without a doubt, of course. So,
thanks, Bem. And that was a really, Steve, I like the way you drew that line there. It makes it very crystal clear.
Bem thinks rigor is dead. That's rigor mortis.
All right, Jay, speaking of pseudoscience, tell us about smart meters. I have a smart meter on my home now because I needed one for the
your solar panels.
Solar panels. Yeah. So is it going to kill me?
This is a great it's a great news item, because it's a perfect example of people that don't understand technology, and they morph it into something that has some type of malfeasance. And we see this a lot. We're seeing people take
facts and take science and take real news and morph it into something that is false. So this time it's the digital smart meter, like Steve said, and they're used to measure how much electricity is being used, right? You guys might remember the old analog meters, right? The one that had the spinning disc that you could see on the side of your house.
Oh, I love that disc. House.
Yeah, a lot of people, of course, still have these too. I mean,
the dials. Yeah. Yeah, I was fascinated with it as a kid.
Evan, I remember looking at the one at my parents' house growing up, and always like being tempted to mess with it. You know, it was behind that really thick glass dome
with a little plastic lock on it. And I was warned: do not crack that lock. Don't go in there. You'll be, the police will come for you. Huh? If you go there. That's a crime.
It is an actual crime. Yeah,
in a house that's with crazy. Four boys, like the fact that we didn't mess with that thing is a miracle.
I know, right?
Or that you electrocuted yourself at some point along the line.
Now, one thing that those old analog meters, what they don't do and what they didn't do, is they don't collect any metadata about the power usage. All they really do is just say how much power was consumed since the last time that the technician visited the house, you know?
Yeah.
So the new smart meters, these things collect quite a bit of useful information. They can measure the peaks and valleys in your power usage throughout the day. And they also can send the data back and forth to the power company wirelessly. No one has to come to your house. Now, there's a good reason why the power companies want more data about everyone's power use. And it's obvious. I mean, they want to generate a really accurate picture about supply and demand, just being able to supply power during peak needs and during, you know, as an on-need basis. Now, this means that depending on the time of day, you know, less power is being consumed, say, in the middle of the night, wherever you are regionally. And, you know, at a max, it could be during dinner time or during the business day. And what the power companies do is they try to refine the data that they have to load balance the grid to make sure that the power is available to you know, areas that need it when they need it. Now, this information lets consumers save money because the power company can actually, you know, even instruct you on when to consume a lot of power. And I was thinking, Steve, as an interesting side here, let's say you get the Powerwall by Tesla. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, like, maybe
ooh,
you
I
could,
want that.
Me too, man. I want three of them. So you can you can draw power from the grid when the cost is at a minimum, and use it when you know when you have a power need, especially if it's during a peak time when everybody has that power need. Anyway, you know, these are interesting things that we'll all come hopefully see to pass within the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, but just to put that into perspective, I don't know if you're going to talk about the difference between base load and peak load, because the peak energy is more expensive, because you think about it, the power company has to have the capacity to generate as much electricity as is being consumed at the maximal moment.
Yep.
Even if it's just for 30 minutes a day, they need all that capacity just to cover that peak period of demand. And so they bring on the more expensive backup, you know, generators for that to meet that peak demand. So it actually is more expensive for them to generate peak electricity than their base load electricity, which is what they're, the most efficient stuff is what they're using for their base load. So peak shaving, you know, just reducing that peak demand is hugely beneficial and cost saving and good for the environment, because it's also they're using the polluting shit too for the peak demand.
Yep.
Right. And it prevents this last ditch thing, which we see sometimes in developing countries. We even see it sometimes in super big cities like LA, where you have rolling brownouts.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's the only way to be able to keep the pressure off the grid.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, right. Otherwise, everyone goes down. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now here's where things get interesting. So some people are claiming that there are negative health effects from the smart meters. From smart meters.
The meter itself.
Yes, Evan. They complain about like the wireless radio signals that these new meters
use. Oh, here we go.
Use, right?
Here we go.
These are like, yeah, these are using radio signals to communicate the data back and forth to the power companies. Now, do I have to say this? Research has shown that radio waves or non-ionizing radiation, these are not dangerous. Mm-hmm. They have no negative health side effects. Back me up
on
this,
Steve. Cause cancer.
Things like Wi-Fi and frequent daily cell phone use have shown no negative health effects. Seriously, like this might sound like a stupid little experiment, but there'd be a lot of people with brain cancer by now with all the cell phone usage that is going on globally. Like we would know. But there are still people out there trying to convince the world that there is this hidden threat. And some studies have shown that there are biological changes, right, that occur with non-ionizing radiation exposure. Yes, it happens. But there's no proof that it does anything bad to people. And nothing bad has been documented scientifically. So it's not dangerous in the strict sense of that word, that the radiation is not dangerous to human beings, that kind of radio frequency, not dangerous, right? You got that?
So you're saying that Saul Goodman's brother on Better Call Saul is crazy. Yeah.
Yes. So for those people who are hell-bent on believing that these technologies are dangerous, the typical next move here is what? That they say, hey, we're just being cautious. We're just trying to protect the general public. We just want people to be aware and be cautious about the use of these devices. And even though science can't detect a legitimate risk, they will claim that the risk is there, but it's too low to detect yet. We can't detect it yet. And, you know, the common sense here that is if it's not detectable, we're not even seeing any signs of anything at all, that we really just have to say there isn't anything going on that's dangerous because we right. at this point, we would be able to detect it. Now, they're also going to throw in the complete nonsense that some people are sensitive to electromagnetic frequencies. You know where I'm going with this. These are the people that have their Wi-Fi. They hate the Wi-Fi. And thanks to these people, there's been some schools that have had Wi-Fi literally banned from high schools or from whatever schools. Utterly ridiculous stuff.
Not just ridiculous, but like, I don't know. I think that's a violation of your right to learn.
I totally agree, Carol.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just a stupid thing. It really does slowly degrade. Yeah, degrade society. And studies.
A stranger came into my office today. It's a true story. Today, no one I've met before, asked to use the telephone because they were locked out or something or like that. I said, okay, it's this way. They said, are there any computers near the telephone? I said, well, yes, there is. There's a computer at each station. They said, nope, I can't use the telephone. I'm allergic to the radiation of computers. Thank you very much.
Oh,
and they
okay.
Out. Oh, but not the radiation of a telephone.
Apparently not. Right. I didn't even offer her my cell phone. I just figured, okay, better let this person just go.
So, Evan, I'm sure you know that studies have shown that when people are properly blinded against this, they can't actually feel the Wi-Fi. They can't feel it.
Yeah.
So right. You know, there's no sensitivity. Person.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah.
So the other thing is, though, even if you're worried about Wi-Fi, do you know so the smart meters use Wi-Fi to communicate the information back to the power company so they don't have to send a guy out there to read it. Do you know how long in a day the Wi-Fi is active?
How long?
All day?
1.4 seconds.
What?
So they're
That's
worried
insane.
About. I know. They're worried about
just
one
to send
four,
that data, that one time.
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly. And not only that, but it's outside your house, and you know inverse square law. So that you're getting thousands of times more radiation from your microwave, from you using your phone.
Seriously,
one phone call is worth 20 years of having a smart meter on your house.
Steve, I would argue that eating a banana gives you more radiation.
Yeah, no, probably true.
It's like saying I swallowed an apple seed once. I'm going to die of arsenic poisoning or something to that effect.
Some of these smart meter devices, when they were first rolling them out, there was a particular model that was, you know, some of them were causing fires, right? We've heard this before. You know, anything with a rechargeable battery or devices like this, there could be design flaws. So, oh boy, what do you think the company did? They re-engineered it, fixed the problem, and they – you know,
recall
them, and they continue to sell these products. And, you know, we don't hear houses burning down every day from smart meter fires, right? You know, but they'll take that. They'll take these very low number of incidents and say, look, and they're absolutely a hazard to humanity because they're even burning down people's houses. And the other thing is the Big Brother angle, too. So they'll come out with, well, the power company is using them to track you. And, you know, now keep in mind that the power company makes money when you use more power. So why would the power company want to limit or track your use of power? If anything, they should be using the Wi-Fi on that device to coax you into using more power.
Also, the power company already reads your damn meter. That's why you get an electric bill that's different every month.
Yeah, but Kara, now they're going to know when you're using
exactly,
your
Kara.
Power.
Oh, this
I
is
see.
An
and before you know
God,
it,
infiltrating
Kara,
on your private. Mm-hmm.
They're going to know what color your underwear is and when is your dog sitting on your lap and what's
right
it,
now
and what's
when you're recharging your batteries for your devices.
Is there a board of people sitting around in the power company's headquarters sequestered away in some old nuclear silo that are like, okay, so how are we going to control everyone? You know, what are we going to do with these meters that we got on the houses? You know, like, what the hell are you thinking? What's going through your mind when you think
fluoridation didn't work? So I guess they got to go this route.
Like, sure, there's a real concern anytime you introduce an internet-enabled or Wi-Fi-enabled device into your sphere of electronics. I agree with that. Yes, hackers and anything that can, anything that is in the Internet of Things that's connected and all that. Yes, we have to be smart about all that. But I got to tell you, you drive down the road with your wireless laptop with the battery charged. This is called war driving. Drive down the road and park in front of any house. And statistically, you have a good chance of being able to get on their Wi-Fi because people don't even use a password on their Wi-Fi network, on their network.
Or their password is password.
Right. Or it's admin. It's out of the box. It's the password. So you can't tell me that we have to be worried about these meters going onto our houses and security when a huge part of the population that's on the Internet doesn't even password protect their own Wi-Fi password, which is essentially to a hacker. That's like your front door is open and all your silverware is on the kitchen table.
Yeah. That's right. So
there you go.
What's interesting, I do think that there is a risk to hacking it, though, because as you say, though, it's not like a unique or the only security risk, but you could imagine somebody hacking in and then saying, okay, who's not home? You know, because who's not using electricity? And then they could just basically get a map of all the homes where people are on vacation or they're not around. That's like the one thing I could think of where like that would be a vulnerability.
I agree, Steve. That's like Facebook in a sense. Like, hey, I'm going to Florida tomorrow.
Exactly.
I only post my pictures after I get home.
Yeah,
a lot of people actually do workarounds with that because a lot of people have smart lights now and they actually turn their lights on certain times of day to deter criminals.
Yep.
Right. So there's a small potential risk of hacking in there. But it's like it's small compared to what's already out there, as you say, like what the risks that are already there. But I do think, sure, the government should keep a close eye on it, should make sure that they're taking reasonable steps to protect this infrastructure from hacking. Who knows what else they might be able to do? You know, suddenly you get a $20,000 electric bill or whatever. You know, who knows? So I think just generically, any new Wi-Fi digital technology, you know, that's the Internet of Things, as you say, Jay, we need to be very security conscious because there are people out there who are smart and creative and will cause mayhem just to do it. And then also, you know, a lot of people are saying that cyber warfare is the new warfare and
cyber terrorism.
Yeah, cyber terrorism. Yeah. We have to take that seriously. But this is part of that bigger picture. This is not a reason not to get a smart meter.
Of course not.
Yeah, that's why you iterate. It's like every time a new technology comes out, somebody's going to try and ruin it or use it to their advantage. And then we're going to plug the holes and build more patches. And it's just an arms race, you know, but it's going to continue to happen. You never want to turn back around because of a fear of the future.
One fascinating thing to me was how similar the anti-smart meter phenomenon
Steve.
Like anti-GMO. It's like all the arguments and the logical fallacies are the same. They decide that they're anti-smart meter and then they marshal every argument they can. They burst into flames. The Wi-Fi is not safe. It's the big brother is going to control when you have dinner. You know, it's like they take it all out of context, out of proportion, make it seem like it's a unique threat of smart meters, and they try to marshal that in anti-smart meter propaganda. Really, the identical process as the anti-GMO movement, and I think based similarly in the same kind of paranoia. We don't want the government and corporations having any kind of influence over something that's important to us.
Yeah,
anti-fluoridation.
Right. Yeah. These are people that are against progress, whether they realize it or not. I mean, you think about these smart meters. They're essential for the electric economy. They're essential for our next move in the next 10 years globally here, guys, right? We're trying to get off of fossil fuels for extraordinarily legitimate reasons.
For real.
And you have people making waves about a simple device that could help maximize our power use and understanding about, it's just utterly ridiculous. And we all have to make sure, like, this is a job of a skeptic now. It's these news items that we need to digest and understand so we could be there in the office or at the kitchen table at the next holiday where someone brings this up and starts talking smack about this. And you go, whoa, hold on a second. You know, you got to be the rational person in the room.
And then what's funny, they say like, oh, they're going to use this to charge us more for peak energy than off-peak energy. And I'm like, yeah, they will. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Is that it's more expensive to generate, so they should charge you more for it to make to encourage you to use your, you know, run your dishwasher off peak, then peak.
Supply and demand, baby.
A very minimal sort of thing to have people do. And that could make a huge difference to the energy infrastructure and, you know, for the efficiency of our energy production and reduce the environmental impacts. So sure, I'll run the dishwasher at, you know, at night or during the day instead of at peak hours to try to save the peak load a little bit. Sure, that's fine.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's called helping out. That's called being in a society.
It is.
Absolutely.
And a modern dishwasher is programmable. You can probably time it to go off at 3 in the morning.
You can do that with all your like really major appliances. Like when I got my electric car, there was an incentive here to have a smart meter put on. Like the electric company would give me a reduced rate on, you know, off peak because of the electric car. And it's like, yeah, I'm not going to plug my car in the middle of the day. Like that doesn't make any sense anyway. Right. Plug it in at night, let it juice up. Wow. It's charged by morning. And those little things, those are just decisions we make as we progress. The same way that our parents didn't argue, or maybe our parents' parents didn't argue about making sure you turn off the light when you leave the room. But that was beat into me when I was a child. Oh, yeah. So now I don't even think about it. I just never leave lights on if I'm not in that room.
Yeah, me too.
Or turn off the water when you're brushing your teeth.
Exactly. Right, it's easy, but like you have to know to do it and be mindful the first 100 times. And then after that, you don't even think about it anymore.
Kara, I think of you every time I brush my teeth now and leave the
I do it as well.
That's so creepy.
I am the teeth guy here. What the hell? Kara's moving in on my territory. What do you know about fluoride, Kara?
It's actually about water.
It's about not wasting water. Well, we talked about that on the
water.
Show.
You can't waste water.
I love it.
Yeah, the clouds will just make
on the
more.
Tales of this news item. That's what you say.
Jay, who's that noisy time?
Who's that noisy? Last week I played this noisy. Any guesses, guys?
I mean, that really, I know it's not it, but it does sound right out of
Close Encounters
of the Third Kind. Yeah. I know it sounds like an elephant.
That's exactly what I thought. Yep.
I'm very disappointed in Steve and Kara, in particularly, about this noisy.
Why? It's going to be some weird brain processing of something that. Here we go.
This is marvelously the sound of a Parasaurolophus.
Parasaurolophus.
It's the sound of what they think a Parasaurolophus is.
Yes.
Like.
Now listen, I will explain. In 1995, an extremely well-preserved Parasaurosalosalosiphus,
which is a Parasaurolophus
skull, was found. They found a really well-preserved Parasaurolophus skull.
Julia could pronounce that word when she was 4 years old.
You know what? Apparently, I have a problem with this, and I'm feeling a lot of negative energy towards me. Okay, and I feel
Are we making fun of your disability?
No, exactly. I don't like it when people make fun of me and my people who are called mispronouncers. By the way, that's a technical term.
Mrs. Pronouncers.
Yes. So I would like a little love and respect and a front seat on the bus. Right. So here
Evan,
we go.
George W. Bush. Get all the respect.
You asked what a Parasaurolophus is. You know, it's the dinosaur with the crest on its head.
Yeah, the guy that has a big crest.
The Parasaurolophus.
It's a hadrosaur.
It's a hadrosaur
from the Cretaceous period. Okay.
That was good, Jay. All those were right.
It has enough. If there's too many syllables, forget it. Okay, here we go. 2 years later, computer scientists and paleontologists did a CAT scan of the skull. And what they found was, first off, that they were unbelievably shocked at how well preserved it was. But they were able to make a 3D model inside of the software of the skull. Then the software was able to simulate air going through the empty cavity. So in the sound that I played, there are two different sounds that I played. One of them is their interpretation of what it would sound with and one without vocal cords. Mm-hmm. I don't know where they're getting. Yeah, I don't know where they got the vocal cord information from, but it's. I think because that's the shape of the skull and the air going through it, it's pretty close to at least in certain aspects to what the real thing sounded like 70 million years ago.
I don't know, but wow, we just don't know because of the soft tissue that we don't have, right?
Right. Yeah. None of that gets really fossilized.
But just air passing through it has a sound. So we know at least that it would build upon that sound and just be modulated in some way.
Right.
Yeah. It'd be funny to think it had all this tissue in there and it came kind of out like a squeak. You're like, beep, beep, beep. you want a dinosaur to be like, yo, I'm here, you know? But maybe not. You never know.
It also reminds me a little bit of the, from the movie War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise, the sound that the walkers made.
Oh,
which
yeah.
is genuinely frightening. That's that deep, resonant, far off, massive sound where you know something big and dangerous is coming after you.
Mm-hmm. Oh gosh,
those walkers were awesome.
Yeah. Genuinely frightened if I had to stand face to face with a Parasaurolophus, definitely.
And I always thought, Steve, you know, listening to that sound in the movie because I had the same reaction that we're hardwired to fear that.
Yeah, maybe.
You know. All right, so guys, first of all, I will remind the audience that Adrian Robles from Mexico sent that in, and we have a winner from last week. Monty Harper said, "Hi, Jay, I know what this is. It's a simulation of what a Parasaurolophus may have sounded like." Parasaurolophus.
You're so close that time.
Parasaurolophus.
Parasaurolophus.
Parasaurolophus. There's actually
Parasaurolophus.
There's a Saurolophus.
Oh, you did it.
There's a Saurolophus and a Parasaurolophus.
Okay.
Oh, that means two of them.
I'll start over. Parasaurolophus.
Hi,
Jay, I know what that is. Parasaurolophus.
Saurolophus.
Ronald McDonaldus?
Saurolophus.
You got it. Jay, that was it.
Parasaurolophus.
Yes.
You got it.
Hi, Jay. I know what that is. It's a simulation of what a Parasaurolophus may have sounded like.
Saurolophus.
I can't do it, Kara. I literally can't do it.
I'm dying. I'm like, I'm crying.
I can't do it.
Oh, Jay, never change. I love you so much.
I don't hear it. I can't hear it for some reason. I'm sorry.
It's the phonemes.
Based on the shape of the trombone that grew out of its skull.
Oh, that's so good. That's a great description, actually.
So thank you, Monty. And Monty said, and I'm not joking, he said, I know this because many years ago I wrote a song about it. And he sent me the song.
Let the heat go.
So I'd love to read it, but it's too long. Anyway, it's really cute. Thank you, Monty. Thank you for winning this week. Oh my God, the last freaking verse here is, please Parasaurolullaby me off the bed. Oh, you are so adorable. It's ridiculous. Okay. A notable guest was from Michael Musto, and he says, "Hi, this is Mike from Canada. This week's noisy is the reconstructed sound of that dinosaur." Yes, he literally sent his email in about a minute and a half after the guy that won. So you almost won. Aww. The worst guest this week was a longtime listener from Scott Guthrie. He said, "First time caller, I think this week's noisy is a naval ship sounding off in the New York Harbor during Fleet Week."
Wow. Oh. Specifically the New York Harbor.
That was a fun one. I really thought that Kara and Steve were going to know, but they didn't know.
I haven't encountered that, but that's cool. I like that.
All right, here's this week's noisy.
Jay, what do you got for this week?
Here is this week's noisy. There you have it.
That's a playing card clipped to a bicycle tire.
It does kind of sound like that, does it? Yeah, it does sound like a film projector. All wrong, but those are fun. So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, if you think you know how to pronounce a Parasaurolophus better than me, or if you have an awesome noisy, I need these noisies. Send them to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right, we're going to do one email this week. This is an interesting one, maybe a little controversial. We'll see. You guys heard of the conceptual penis?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, all right. Jan from Boston writes, "I am sure you've read about it and gotten multiple mails regarding this article, but I thought it would tickle your fancy. Then she links to the article about the conceptual penis. Another nonsense study that managed to get published in a not-so-great journal. Not really a surprise, especially if you are willing to pay. I reviewed an article once for a similar journal, recommended rejection, and never heard back. Turns out the article was published. That was the last time I spent my time for random open-access journal reviews. Okay, so here's the basic story. Two academics, Peter Boghossian and James Lindsay, published a paper in a gender studies journal. And at the same time, they published another article in Skeptic magazine revealing the other article to be a Sokol-style hoax. So if you remember from, you know, a few years ago, Sokol published an article in the journal Social Text that, and then simultaneously published an article in another journal saying, yep, that article I published in Social Text is all bullshit. I just made up some incomprehensible nonsense just to show that the postmodernist literature will publish anything, and even if it is incoherent mess. So this was an attempt to replicate the Sokol hoax in a gender studies journal in order to demonstrate essentially the same thing, that that the field of gender studies is academically vacuous. Like this is an expose. It's like a gotcha moment.
Oh, so really they were trying to say this field is vacuous, not this specific journal doesn't have high standards.
Yeah, the whole field.
Well,
yikes. Yeah, that's really overreaching.
So that's the problem. So it sounds like it's backfired, and I have to, you know, I do think that interpretation is correct. So apparently, Boghossian and Lindsay submitted their hoax paper to a more respected journal, Norma, the International Journal for Masculinity Studies, and which the journal apparently is ranked 115th out of journals in gender studies. So this is a low rank but legitimate journal, and they rejected it. So then they published it in an open access, pay to publish vanity journal that has no academic standing. So
isn't that kind of like a press release almost?
Yeah, basically means nothing. What they did means nothing.
Right. Yeah. So if they were trying to prove that the field has a problem with academic legitimacy, they failed to demonstrate that. And in fact, they ironically, I think, demonstrated that they at least had enough respectability that the 115th ranked journal, you know, in terms of their impact factor, rejected their paper, you know. So if their hypothesis was that we could get a respected journal to accept it, their hypothesis was disproved. What they did show is what we already know from previous studies that we've talked about, is that there's a lot of predatory pay-to-publish journals out there that have no real editorial or peer review process. Even if they're technically peer-reviewed, they will publish anything. So they demonstrated that. Now, again, if we think about this as any kind of scientific experiment, you have to control for variables before you could say what the implication is. So we have two variables here, the academic legitimacy of gender studies and the publishing legitimacy of these open access journals. Because they were rejected from a traditional journal and they only published in a pay-to-publish journal, those two variables are mixed. So they can't make any conclusions about the academic legitimacy of gender studies based upon the fact that they were able to publish it in a low-rank, open-access, you know, pay-to-publish journal. So they didn't prove what they set out to prove. And the conclusions, the sweeping conclusions that they draw in their article in Skeptic, I don't think are justified. I do think that this backfired.
Honestly, even if they published in a higher ranking journal, if their study slipped past reviewers, if, you know, which would not be good, and they could have some really damning things to say about that journal or about the editors of that journal, it still, I don't think, would nullify an entire field.
No, but they would have something. But they would have a point at that. I think then they would.
They would have a point.
If they got it published in like a respected, you know, high-ranking journal in the field, that would be damning. You're right.
Yeah,
you're right in that you still have to be, you know, cautious about the conclusions you draw from it. And a lot of people point out that Sokol in his paper, his reveal paper, was very cautious in his conclusions and said, this does not mean that the whole field is not legitimate, et cetera, et cetera. He just, you know, was very, very conservative, like a good scientist mm-hmm. should be, in the conclusions that he was drawing from that. And he had a much better case than these guys. So I think they just have to suck this one up and say, yeah, we set out to do this. It didn't work. But, you know, this doesn't mean that there aren't legitimate criticisms of the field. It doesn't right. really say anything about sure. it one way or the other. Just like I do think, you know, I think that postmodernism as applied to any empirical claims, scientific claims, is not legitimate. And I do yeah. think that there are legitimate criticisms that can be made about academic areas that go too far down that postmodernist rabbit hole. Because once mm-hmm. you say that nothing really means anything, that everything's a construct, then you have no legitimate basis to judge anything.
Right. What's your measuring stick?
Well, you can't make scientific claims about
right,
the world.
That's what I mean.
I think that yeah. it's a valid conversation to be had in a philosophy course.
Sure.
You know,
humanities, or a philosophy.
Field. Sure, you can talk
exactly. yourself out. Yeah, I agree.
But isn't gender studies generally considered within the humanities, or is it considered in the social sciences?
Social science, I think.
Really?
I think it's
psychology.
I think it straddles the humanities and the social sciences.
Gotcha.
And I think that might also be where, you know, you could make some legitimate criticisms. But again, they just didn't manage to do it. You know,
mm-hmm.
You can't make any conclusions based upon the fact that they got their paper published in the low rank, you know, open access journal.
In a low rank pay to play.
But I will say that the paper that they wrote is kind of brilliant satire. You know, if you just read it, I mean, it's funny to read it. You
it's
know?
A, yeah, it is a hot flaming piece of garbage.
Yeah, right. But
the
on
best
purpose,
way
on purpose. So they did a
on
good,
purpose,
they did
yeah.
a good job. They did a good job of writing the article. Because it is this jargon. It's like that jargon game that we played. So they just
yeah, yeah. it
they
feels like an onion
article. Yeah, they wrote
it's like an onion journal article.
Exactly.
Are so the guys who wrote it scientists?
They give up. Yeah. So one's a educator and engineer. Let me see.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, one's a PhD, I think a philosopher PhD, the other one's an EDD.
A philosopher, gotcha. Okay. Yeah, because I feel like, you know, the paper, like you said, is well written, even though it's full of garbage. And the experiment is interesting, but of course, it's the companion piece that they wrote in Skeptic that was problematic and I think in some ways, like incredibly unscientific.
Revealed their
they're
bias.
Not, yeah,
I
they're
suppose.
Not proving anything.
They should have just kept trying to submit it to more prestigious journals. Because,
well, yeah, why did they stop at yeah right at accepting
maybe,
this
that's
level?
What maybe I they could get. Have made it like yeah. slightly less blatant. They might have had a better chance.
Yeah,
I think they should have given it more time to bake.
So yeah, I guess they were just anxious to get it out there, and then they just convinced themselves that okay, you know, and they try to justify it by saying that well, the publishing company that publishes this open access journal is respectable. Who cares? I'm sorry, but that doesn't rescue it. And mm-hmm. but this has been controversial, you know, within the skeptical community, because I think there are some people who still want to hold on to the criticism and are saying what this is still important. But I just have to disagree. I think that you've mixed your variables here, so you can't make this conclusion. If you're going to pull out, and this has been our, because you know this is interesting, because like Jay and I and all of us, from the beginning of our skeptical careers, going back 20 years, we've always had this occasional conversation of, should we try to pull off a hoax?
Should we hoax?
In order
right.
to make yeah. a point. Because
not worth it, too risky.
And we've always decided.
Do it perfectly.
Yeah, we've always decided that we don't want to do it because you do have to pull it off. You have to know exactly what you're doing. And the worst yeah. thing you could do is to try to pull off a hoax and fail, because
yeah.
then it really does reflect badly on the whole skeptical movement, not only you yourself. And so it was just for us, it was too high risk, and we didn't feel like we had the skill set to pull it off to our.
Sure. Plenty of historical examples of this, too. Ask Randy alone.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Just ask him.
Yeah. I mean, Randy himself has done a couple of hoaxes in his career, but he's done like two in 50, 60 years, because he's probably the best person to pull it off of and anyone in the skeptical community, and even he has done it extremely rarely. And then oh, yeah. even when, I mean, I think, you know, he pulled off the
Jose.
Yeah, the Jose one. And then he also did the one with Banachek, right, with the kids in the...
Project Alpha.
Yep. So I think he pulled them off as good as you possibly can. And still, it was like, yeah, you know, he paid the price in terms of, well, you know, he's a hoaxer.
Right. Results. Yeah.
He got labeled for
it's
it.
It's the, right? we kind of touched upon this in our recent interview with Mark, that the whole, it's the pig problem.
Yeah.
That if you a pig, ironically, you're still a pig. You know what I mean? So if you pull off a hoax for a reason, you still are a con artist. Yeah, you still are a hoaxer.
And you're going to get true believers following you. Yeah. Like, well, that might happen. Yeah.
There's a side effect to that, sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, okay. So interesting.
Good. This is a good reminder.
It's a good reason. It's a cautionary tale. Very good reminder. Something you never want to be. It's a cautionary tale. Okay. Let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake, and I challenge my panelists, skeptics, to tell me which one is the fake, except this week we have a theme and we have four items. And the theme is goats. We'll see how much you guys know about goats.
I hate
wow,
your
really?
Guts.
Okay. I stared at
Phil Plait would own this.
I know. I just found out that Phil is like raising goats.
Is he online? Where's he? Is he on
Skype?
Oh
my God. He's obsessed with goats. Yeah. He's got a ton of them.
He probably knows all of these. Okay. Here we go. Uh-huh. Four items. Bob, you had something to say over there?
Yeah, I'm just reveling in the fact that I can say something right now, which I never ever do because I went first last week, so I will not go first again. even if you tell me to, because I spoke right now.
What, Bob?
He can renege on that anytime.
Oh, Bob.
That's true. Okay, here we go. Item number one. Because of their rebellious nature, goats were difficult to domesticate, which likely did not occur until about 3,000 years ago. Item number two. Moroccan goats climb to the tops of trees where they graze on leaves and nuts and spit out seeds to help spread the trees. Item number three, scientists have found that goats have regional accents and will change their accent when they move to a new region.
Awesome.
And item number four, goat's milk is naturally homogenized, contains less fat, and is consumed by more people around the world than cow's milk. Evan, I do think it's time that you've gone first.
Goats have a rebellious nature. That is apparently a fact. And therefore, difficult to domesticate. Only up to 3,000 years ago. Only 3,000 years ago did they start to get domesticated. Well, that this doesn't seem likely. See, I don't know. It seems like goats have always been part of the background of all sorts of, you know, biblical stories and stuff. And that spans further back. And those stories are told that span back past 3,000 years. So I would think if they're in the stories that there's likely some form of domestication that went on there. Maybe that's a clue as to why that one would be fiction. The second one about Moroccan goats specifically, they climb to the top of trees and graze on leaves and nuts. Well, these, you know, not all trees are built the same. The trees could be very short. I mean, you know, we're not calling about the California redwoods or something. They eat the leaves and nuts. Spit out the seeds, spread the trees. I think that one's going to turn out to be correct. Climbing goats. Hell, they climb mountains very well. Why not little trees? Shrubberies. The third one about scientists finding that goats have regional accents. Fascinating. And change their accent when they move to a new region. What? They study this? This is an Ig Nobel story, I think. You know, you get an Ig Nobel Prize for that. The last one, goat milk is naturally homogenized. Nice. Contains less fat. Oh, I can believe that. Consumed by more people around the world than cow's milk. That I do definitely do believe. Not in North America, but look, you know, North America is a minority of the world, not a majority. So, goats are everyone else. So is it 3,000 years ago domestication or is it the accents? I am going to go with my second instinct, and I will say that it is the, damn it. No, I'm going with my first instinct. 3,000 years ago, I think because it definitely happened before that. It's in the stories and the Bible and things like that. Therefore, it had to be before 3,000 years ago. I say that one's the fiction.
Wow, an argument from the Bible. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, huh?
Jay?
I mean, I do like Evan's point on that first one. Wow, this is really hard. Okay, Evan made a good point about that first news item, about because they're in the Bible, it has to be more than 3,000 years ago. Let's go to the second one here, goats climbing trees. Yes, I agree with that. No reason to think that they don't do that. And I'm sure that whatever they find up there, they're eating. Scientists have found the regional accents. Odd, but strangely probably true. I know that birds have this as well, and that even cool. animals' accents can change over time. So I do believe that one is science. Naturally homogenized. Seems kind of odd to me that it's naturally homogenized and is consumed by more people around the world than cow's milk. Yeah, I agree with the second half of that. I just don't know enough about... That's interesting. There is something about that first one, though, that doesn't seem correct. 3,000 years is not a long time. Not long enough. I think that one's the fake.
Okay, Bob.
All right, so start from the bottom. I felt similarly. Naturally homogenized is... I have a problem with that. The other stuff, I don't. The regional accents is just too awesome. And I just want that to be true. Tops of trees. I remember seeing a cliff so steep, essentially vertical, and you see these dark spots all over the cliff. Like, what is that? They zoom in. There's goats on this vertical cliff. It was insane. It's like, how is that possible? They've got
like
hooves.
Like when Kirk was climbing that rock face in Star Trek V.
My God, like,
right?
They were like hanging out on the walls of the cliffs of insanity. They were just like, how can they possibly do that? So trees, like, big deal. I got to give them lots of props. That was an amazing image. So, okay, I'm good with that one. So, yeah, the first one's kind of getting me. They're rebellious. I just love that. Isn't there that famous YouTube video where this guy is yelling at a goat and the goat screams back at the guy?
Yeah.
It's awesome. It's like the scream. It's like a human scream. Ah! I just can't even do it. It was wonderful. I just love that. And then, of course, the caption underneath is, you know, this is an internet argument. So, but yeah, I mean, 3,000, yet again, I think Steve picked the perfect number. It's like, okay, 3,000, that's far. That's a long time ago, but it might be good, might not be quite good, and, you know, too far, not far enough, blah, can't decide. But I'm still going to go with that one and say the domestication is fiction.
And Kara.
Come
on, Kara.
If I step out of line, I may be changing the statistical capability of Steve to sweep us. If I stay with you guys, man, it could be any of the other three.
Go with your heart.
Okay. No, I'm not going to go with my heart. I'm going to go with my brain.
That's what I meant.
Your bleeding heart.
So I'm going to agree with the guys that Moroccan goats climbing to the top of trees is not weird. I'm going to be pissed if that's the fiction, though, because it's so obviously like not the fiction. I'm going to say that one's science because they can climb anything and they're climbers. That's like what goats are known for. And then the one that I feel like, Steve, that you threw in to be the obvious fiction, which is probably true, is this damn thing about them having different accents. I wouldn't be surprised if all animals have different accents, depending on where they grow up regionally. I don't know if it would be quite as specific.
Are you making a cultural argument?
I don't know if it would be quite as specific as, like, you know, the Texas accent versus the Arkansas accent, but maybe a certain type of goat in the Middle East would have a different accent than its sister goat. Gosh, okay, I know nothing about goats.
Phil Plate, where are
you? I know. So the two, just like the other guys that really stick out to me, I totally buy that goat's milk has less fat because it's like a health fad to drink goat's milk. And I buy that more people drink goat's milk than cow's milk. But the naturally homogenized thing is bugging me. Wouldn't it be naturally homogenous? Homogenization by definition is a process. That one does really bug me, and there's a part of me that wants to say that that's the fiction. Although the other, I don't feel like you would have one out of a list of three be fiction. And then 3,000 years ago, I mean, agriculture is what, like 12,000 years old? Goats are early agricultural species, are they not? I don't know why. I feel like every, like, papyrus painting of agriculture has goats on But maybe, right. I mean, well, maybe they're sheep. They probably look the same in those crappy drawings. But I think I want to stick with the guys, and I'm going to say that they were domesticated probably closer to like 8,000 or even maybe 12, maybe like 12, 15, like whenever agriculture actually started.
Okay, so you guys all agree. So
I'm scared.
You might have a sweep.
Let's start with number two. Well, we're going to have a sweep one way or the other. We'll see.
One way or the other.
So number two, Moroccan goats climb to the tops of trees where they graze on leaves and nuts and spit out seeds to help spread the trees. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is, wouldn't it be great if this one were fiction?
I would kill you.
This one is science. This one is science, yeah. So, they climb to the top of the argan tree, which they eat the leaves, and then when the nuts are out, they eat the nuts, and they spit out the seeds.
Oh, is that where we get argan oil
maybe.
From?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I see that in a lot of, like, conditioner, like hair conditioner.
But it's weird to see, like, a picture of a tree, and there's goats on the top of it, you know? Right. But you're right, they're climbers. Goats are climbers. They will climb on top of cows. You know,
and
just to have awesome. Something, just to have something and to climb on top of. You know,
will they eat the nuts that they find there?
Oh,
so
I highly recommend you guys follow Phil Plate's Instagram feed if you're on Instagram, because his goats climb on him.
Yeah,
they'll like climb on his head. It's very cute.
And just climb did you see on the anything. Article this week about goat yoga? That's a fad.
That's so stupid.
No, people go into yoga silly. Positions. They have goats stand on them and bridge over two people. And it's called goat yoga.
That can't possibly
not.
Be true.
Of Jay, course that's true. I'm Look sure that up. Happens goat down yoga. The street from my apartment.
It is
from my
a
house
fad.
Goats don't Crazy. Eat grass. What they do is they browse on lots of other types of stuff, you know, tree bark and
Are you serious? That could have been a science
and,
or fiction.
And leaves and stuff. They do have four stomachs, you know, the four-chambered stomach that they use like to ferment and digest the stuff that they eat.
And maybe homogenize. Yeah.
They don't eat like tin cans. That's a myth. But they will. But they will chew on anything that they think is food. They just won't eat it. You know what I mean? They'll chew on cardboard, whatever. But they won't eat the stuff. Okay, let's go to number three. Since you guys were all pretty certain about that one as well. Scientists have found that goats have regional accents and will change their accent when they move to a new region. You guys all think that that one is science, and that one is. Science. They do have accents.
Too weird awesome. To not sure. be science.
So, yeah, I suppose I borrow it from other things. But the it's actually very rare among mammals, at least
oh,
in
is.
Terms
oh, okay.
of which. So I've read several different articles about this news item because I always try to multi-source these things. And everyone said that, oh, this has only been shown in a few other mammals. Then they give a list of different mammals that they say it was shown in. So, like, one article said just humans, bats, and whales. Then another article is like, it's humans, you know, elephants, and some other, and dolphins.
Tigers.
Okay. And that list is getting longer and longer.
So, okay, whatever. So, it's apparently humans, bats, whales, dolphins, and elephants have been shown to have accents. But, and they did show that the kids, the baby, the goats, will pick up an accent fairly quickly. And that if you move them to a different herd, they pick up the accent of that herd, you know, and they speculate that this could have been a mechanism for recognizing like who belongs to the herd and who's an outsider because they, you know, they have a different accent. They could different vocal range, different repertoire of the sounds that they make.
Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. As opposed to smell that or something. Yeah.
Well, goat would goats, emanate. As you guys have noted, are very vocal. They will scream like people, you know.
Oh, they bleat.
They bleat, yeah.
Yeah.
They make a lot of noise, absolutely.
Blah.
Okay.
That was great.
Let's go to number four.
Exactly. like a weird human trying to vomit. That's what they sound like.
Goat's milk is naturally homogenized, contains less fat, and is consumed by more people around the world than cow's milk. You guys all think that all of those things are true?
Not really. We think the first one's
no.
fiction.
I mean, all of the elements of this number, of this one. And this one is...
Science. Baby.
Science. Good job.
Whoa! Yes.
Oh, we did it! So, yeah, so it's you know, cow's milk naturally separates into different layers, and it has to be treated so that it all stays homogenized as one layer, so it doesn't separate out, as you say. But goat's milk does not separate out. It stays homogenized. It's homogenous, as you said, Kara. It also is supposed to be a lot healthier than cow's milk. It has less fat than cow's milk. It also has less of the proteins that provoke milk allergies, and also is better tolerated by people with lactose intolerance. So
it also tastes like ass.
Well, okay, hold on.
It's like really gross.
That's a problem.
Can't they fix that?
That depends, Kara. So, again, I read a lot about it just in preparation for this. So because it is far more people around the world consume goat's milk than cow's milk, which is mainly a kind of a Western kind of phenomenon. But goat's milk apparently can taste really good, even better than cow's milk. However, if you allow the male goats and the female goats to mix together, the goat smell will get into the milk and it will taste goaty.
When it tastes goaty, it is not good.
Yeah. So if it's properly produced and the female goats are kept separate, it probably also depends on what they eat. But, depending on what you're feeding them, but apparently it can taste fine. It can taste really good. So, I think it just depends is the answer. But yeah, there's that problem of goaty tasting milk if you don't do it properly. Yeah. And then of course, there's lots of cheese made out of goat's milk. You guys see feta cheese, right? Mm-hmm. Feta is.
Oh, sure.
I love feta. It's too goaty.
I like feta cheese. It's tangy. It's very tangy. So it has to be. Ugh. The right amount of too much of it is overwhelming, but just the right amount of it is really good. It gets it.
Nice crumble on a salad.
Yeah, a little crumbled feta on a salad is really good. Okay.
Try it, Kara.
But I like a chèvre. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
Chèvre? I can never. Yeah, that's good.
Goat meat is also supposed to be very healthy for you. Better than red meat or pork. All this means that because of their rebellious nature, goats were difficult to domesticate, which likely did not occur until about 3,000 years ago, is the fiction. In fact, goats were probably the first animal ever domesticated.
Woohoo!
Yeah, first ever, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's why they were on that.
In every freaking Bible story.
So what
ever
was it?
Yeah, and they're on that damn papyrus.
It was 10,000 years ago, probably, that they were domesticated.
Yes. What was it, though?
What was what?
What was the goat before they domesticated it into a goat?
A wild goat. Just a wild goat.
It just screamed a lot louder and more often.
Oh, you mean like a wolf going to a dog?
Did it look really different?
No.
Like,
No, wild goats.
It was just a wild goat.
It was furrier.
It's like a cow, right? They were just wild cows.
Yeah. No, I don't think they looked a lot different. Goats were really easy to domesticate. It's the exact opposite because they're very mellow, actually. They may make a lot of noise and stuff, but they're actually pretty easygoing, apparently.
And isn't there a certain species or breed, I don't know, where if you, scare them, they'll, pass out?
They have... No, they don't pass out. They don't pass out.
They faint.
They don't faint. They're called the fainting goats, but that's a misnomer. They don't faint. They have myotonic dystrophy, which is a neuromuscular disorder. And when they're shocked, their muscles freeze up and they fall over, but they're fully conscious.
Well, that would be an easy goat to domesticate.
Yeah. Well, to control, if you get out of hand, just shout at it and it collapses. But it's a muscle disorder. It's now they don't lose consciousness.
Oh,
but
it's kind of sad. So they actually can feel it. I wonder if that freaks them out.
It's not happy. There are people with that disorder. Oh,
stressful goats. Yeah, you'd bleat all the time if that happened to you.
Yeah, seriously.
Right. There's a lot of YouTube videos looking at the so-called fainting goats, but they're really just with the muscle disorder. Cool. So you guys knew a lot about goats. Yeah, the three. I was trying to get I was trying to decide what was that perfect. It had to be BC, of course. But how many years ago would be clearly wrong, but just barely believable? But I actually, Evan, I didn't think of the biblical angle, so you got me with that one. I might have pushed it to 5,000 years. Yeah,
Disrupting religion.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah. It's my bias, I guess.
But Steve, more importantly than religion. The Nexus Conference is coming up very soon. As we record this, Nexus is...
Jay, you saying that Nexus is more popular than Jesus?
No.
We're bigger than Jesus.
No. it's June 29th to July 2nd, and you can go to necss.org to check out the details. So we have a really cool speaker this year, Britt Marie Hermes, who used to be a naturopathic doctor.
Mm-hmm. A naturopath. And, she's just saying naturopath. Don't say naturopathic doctor. They're not doctors.
So Britt offers her firsthand insider experience on the world of naturopathy and compelling personal stories about how she changed her mind and career. It should be really cool. Here's a cool fun facts about her. She earned her degree in Bastyr University in 2011. She quit The Woo in 2014 after reporting her boss for using a non-FDA-approved drug to treat cancer patients. What does that sound like? In 2015, she started a blog and has gone on to some awesome success. Now she's a contributor to Science Based Medicine. And
which is really the peak of her career. I mean, let's face it.
Yeah, forget about her Forbes column. Yeah, important.
Science Based Medicine, that's the show, man.
She's a lot of fun to listen to. Come to Nexus. We're going to be there.
And
we're going to have a great time.
We have
time.
Other speakers, too. She's not the only one.
Yeah, of course you're
right. Guys, we have an astronaut.
We have a ton of cool speakers. And guys, we're going to be there. We're going to be there. We're going to have a show from the stage. We're going to be doing workshops. We're going to be all over the place. So come see us in New York at the end of June. So, Evan, do you got a quote this week?
I do have a quote this week. Here we go. We have become, by the power of a glorious evolutionary accident called intelligence, the steward of life's continuity on Earth. We did not ask for this role, but we cannot abjure it. We may not be suited to it, but here we are. And that was written by Stephen Jay Gould from his book called The Flamingo's Smile, Reflections in Natural History.
Yep.
I like
which
that.
I'm not familiar with. I will have to add that to my list, my long list of books that I must
read. Yeah, Gould had a monthly column in Natural History magazine for decades, and then he collected them into books. The Flamingo's Smile is one of them. They're all awesome. Nice. I mean, he's actually credited by some people with revising the whole science essay in popular writing because they were just fantastic and definitely
they were wonderful. My God,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, he perfected the style of the essay, especially in the scientific area. So, if you haven't read his books, read them, man. They're great.
Or listen to them. They've got some great narrators.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You're welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Doc.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.